Blog Talk Radio.
Stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening, everybody. I would like to welcome you to the Stop Child Abuse Now talk radio show, sponsored by NASCA, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Penelope Dennis, and I am from Bellevue, Washington. On my host team this evening is Tamika Chambers from Tillamook, Oregon, and I have Annie Margis from Longview, California. Annie is our co-host in training after tonight. She's ready. I'll tell you, she is ready. So we wish to welcome you to the show this evening. And our type of show tonight is special guest night. And I will tell you a little bit more and introduce our very special guest in a few moments. But before I do that, I want to talk to you a little bit about what NASCA is all about. If you are intrigued and would like to join and be a member of the panel this evening on the show, there's no experience necessary. First-time callers are welcome. The number to do so and call in to be a panel member is area code 646-595-2118. Again, that's area code 646-2118. My co-host Tamika will meet you on our back line and greet you and bring you into the show. So we encourage you to call in at any time. This is a 90-minute show, so at any time we would encourage you to give us a call. And as a panelist, you'll have an opportunity to interact with our special guest and ask our guest a question or pose a comment that is related to their story, since it is their time to share their personal history and experiences with us tonight. But as I promised, a little bit more about NASCA. And as you know, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse is all about child abuse, trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA, and it's to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first goal, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And the second goal, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, such as these shows, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. So if you'd like to be a member of the panel this evening, we would highly encourage you to do so. You'll have an opportunity to interact with a special guest. The area code is 646-595-2118. This is SCAN, Stop Child Abuse Now, SCAN 2806, and we have a very special guest tonight. Our special guest is Regla Girl from San Diego, California. Regla Girl is a jazz vocalist, a composer, a songwriter, a music educator with a Master of Music degree from She's also a child abuse survivor and a longtime NASCA family member. In the past, she frequently participated as a panelist on many of our SAN talk shows, and so we are very much looking forward to catching up with her. So to give you a little bit of background about Special Guest Night, the whole idea of these shows is to use a member's personal story to help a newcomer identify. So a newcomer can be anyone, as we stated in the mission, who's interested in learning more about intervention, prevention, and recovery of child abuse, especially as related to adult survivors. So generally, we begin by asking our special guest to tell us the story of their early life. That includes from the time they were born, the earliest memories, what kind of family and community they were born into, and the type of child abuse they experienced. For many, unfortunately, it's sexual assaults of a variety of kinds, but each act of sex between an adult and a child is a criminal offense. Others are abused physically, emotionally, and or through neglect. We like to point out on the show consistently and emphatically, the child is not responsible in any way. Yet we understand many folks who are in need of recovery will feel a sense of misplaced shame, guilt, embarrassment, or responsibility. Family members, we know how they feel. Following a young childhood, we frequently explore a person's teenage and adolescent years, asking if the abuse they went through affected how they felt while growing up. Then we'll discuss in adulthood up to the time a special guest turned the corner into healing. In the last segment of the show, we want to reserve time during each episode to talk about the solution, about our guest's personal healing journey, and what they're doing today. So with all that being said, we're so delighted to have Regla Girl here tonight. And without further ado, I would like to unmute your mic, Regla Girl, bring you to the show. Welcome. You're speaking with Penelope, the host of the show. Welcome this evening.
Hi, Penelope. Thanks. Yes.
How are you
doing? Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. Thank
Great.
You. So may I ask before we begin and I start asking you some questions, do you like to be called Regla Girl or is there another name that you wish to be called?
You can call me Regla Girl. I'm really used to it. And I'll tell a little bit about that in my story, actually. The only
Wonderful.
Thing that I will point out that you can feel free to interrupt me is that I have very few teeth, and so I have to really use effort for pronunciation. And sometimes there's still a loss there. So if you don't understand what I'm saying, feel free to interrupt me. Is what I'd like to say as I start off.
Well,
okay.
Thank you for letting us know. Absolutely, no problem, absolutely. So as I mentioned during the beginning of the show and the introduction, this is your show. You've been a NASCA family member for a long time. I know you've been on the panel. I'm assuming this is not your first time telling your story on the show. Am I correct?
I think it's the second time, but a lot more has happened, and recovery
mm-hmm.
is I feel as though I'm still in the midst of it, and I'll explain a little bit more about that also after I begin. But this NASCA show I consider it to be a really big piece in my recovery, and was a huge and tremendous source of support for me during a time of crisis. It was just because of the availability of it, I knew it was on every day at 5:00. And I knew I was going to be with at least with other people, like say it would be a show like this. So I would at the very least be with other people who understood perhaps what I was going through. And then it got better and better by attracting all kinds of really important to me anyway, professionals in related fields. So I really can't say enough about it. Good thing.
Oh my gosh.
How important it was. Thing.
So beautifully described. Just, I think, the hope and the healing, and just the sense of community and feeling like you're not alone that these shows provide to the world. We're an international organization. And I echo all the comments that you said for me personally. It was on NASCA when I first told my story to the world, and it was a huge step in my recovery and just really feeling empowered. So I appreciate you sharing that. And so many people that are listening, that are streaming in right now, are just learning and benefiting from what you said. So I appreciate that. So as you know, it's your show. It's your show, and so this is obviously what's within your comfort level. You're in control about what you wish to share. And as we break to the panel, and we try and break to the panel twice during the show, once at about 30-minute mark and once at the 60-minute mark, if you're asked a question that you're not comfortable with, that is your right. You're in control, and you have a choice. So I just wanted to make sure to put that out there, and that was clear. But also, as you mentioned, we're on five nights a week, 5 o'clock, and there are shows if you're not able to, 5 o'clock, excuse me. I love the fact that you're in San Diego because I'm in Seattle, so we're both on, and Tamika's in Oregon, and actually Andy's in California, so we're all in Pacific time, but we have all different time zones, Colin. So if you're not able to listen to the show when it's on live, they are archived, and they are available in our archives, and so we do like to structure them with some consistency just because they are utilized as archive shows. So we like to start just with some, paint a picture, if you wouldn't mind, for those who are listening in on our panel. We've got a robust panel actually called in on the line in support of you tonight. And also I know we have a lot of listeners. Just to give us some background, paint a picture of you. And as you came to the world, a little bit of a, if we could imagine, you know, with the imagery where you were born, location-wise, who was in your family, and take us from there.
Sure. And I wanted to remember. Even as a child, I remember making it a point to remember. I will talk about my childhood, but I wanted to say, to start off by talking about just kind of spinning off on what you were talking about regarding the need for this, and recently and my recovery, because I wouldn't be doing this if there wasn't recovery, you know. And I believe there's still too much silence. There's still too much silence due to the shame and fear of retribution and or punishment for remembering. So actually, I wrote this. I'm going to finish reading this if you don't mind. I wrote this in preparation for tonight. These memories shift accountability on the playing field of the planet, creating possibilities for transformation, and I think we all know it needs change. In light of what's been uncovered in terms of child trafficking, as an example, you know, the Maxwell Epstein case is being covered as we speak, and there are aspects of that case that are, as you may hear as I tell my story, relevant. So my recovery, though, needs to be at the beginning, because at some point it had to be my way of life. I will share that. I had to give it my all. And I remember being so angry about this. I really remember this, the fact that I was going to have to give it my all, the fact that I was still being robbed of my own life. I don't know if you know what I mean by that, but like in terms of time and energy, it was like the ultimate F me. Like even once I discovered what was going on, the fact that I knew I was just going to have to give it my all in order to just survive, it seemed like, but not just survive, because there were pieces or elements of my story, my personal story, that it seemed to me might really help others. I mean, I think everybody's story does this, what I'm saying. It touches reaches out and it touches people in a way, you know, in certain unique ways. Then we call that identification, you know, that maybe no other does. But I think that there are some aspects here, and yet, I became like just so angry about this. Like, again, now I'm going to have to, like, this is going to have to be it. I'm going to have to give my whole life, because as you heard, you know, I was a musician. I just wanted to live. No, please, I'm not saying it. I just wanted to live. You couldn't hear? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm just saying that actually, if you would like to go chronologically through life, could you just give us some information on where you were born and who was in your family of origin?
Sure. So I was born in Massachusetts, in Leominster, Massachusetts. But that's just because my father was in the Army. It was New York City. So I was born into a Catholic family in New York City in 1955. And I was the oldest of three children. So a year later, my brother was born. However, I went on an airplane with my mother as an infant to Germany, where then my brother was born a year later. And then I had a sister who was born a year after that. So it was this atmosphere for me of I had people to play with, and I loved that. And there were connections that were formed. And however, there was family, extended family, grandma, grandpa, you know, there were two sets of grandparents. However, as you will hear, I was born into a family that had been abused and traumatized already. So there was a lot of that into the grandparents. The grandparents' personal history had trauma and abuse in it that was actually even mentioned whenever they would get shit-faced drunk on holiday occasions. So that's what I was born into. And I was, I can still see, you know, the pictures, images of rooms and people and clothing could tell you great details about my life, even at from 2.5 years old to 3 years old. Now, we did move periodically, and I think that helps with memory, you know, because there's these different locations, so I can, you know, adjust that's how old I was. But to tell you the truth, chronologically through my whole life, and I became involved, as I said, in recovery, which required me to delve deep into the story anyway. But there are mysteries. There were real mysteries in the family history that required like a sort of detective life delving into, you know. That's what I would discover later, you know, after my teenage years. But I was I found out later that I don't remember the being slapped on the face a lot, you know, something wipes that out, but I know it was my mother. I learned that later, although that was hidden for a long time, that's who she was, but it was a family where spanking was okay, and I guess that would have been that, except for the sexual abuse that happened. On my mother's side of the family, so my mother's mother, my grandmother, and her sister were raised in a Catholic orphanage. So they had witnessed the murder of their mother when my grandmother was 8. And then the younger sibling and then their brother was maybe 4, but they lived on the east side of Manhattan. And their real father had died in that flu, and apparently, and we had the newspaper article from this event, this traumatic event that I'm going to tell you about, which was this man, they lived in what are row houses in the city, and knocked the door down and shot her with a gun. She threw the baby on the bed. My grandmother hid and says she remembered it, and then he ran into the street and shot himself. And because there was a small political gathering, a meeting, and because there were so many newspapers back in that day, you know, the story was picked up. And they went to orphanages. So as a child, this is related to me, as a child, I was listened to these stories about the orphanages and about this traumatic event over and over and over. I mean, on my father's side, there was also another story like that. Now, how this played out for me in my recovery was that I ended up in AA and OA when I was very young, like I was 18, 19. My sister was 2 years younger. She 12-stepped me in there. So this is back in like the mid-70s, right? But this is where you tell it. This is where you learn to tell your story, right? You hear people's story.
Yes.
And
so you're getting. So I appreciate you.
And one of the things one of the things that happens to me, which I believe is a result of the abuse, is that I couldn't tell my story. I was always telling their stories. You know.
Right. That's a good point. Well, that's a lot for a child to listen to. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, we should. I believe it. Child maltreatment is also imposing on children. Children need to be children. Children do not need to be forced to be adults or listen to adult content when they're children. And that is very traumatic for you to hear those stories about your family of origin, about your grandmother and what your mother had witnessed. Those are very traumatic.
Yes. It is, and it was. And the other thing, and this goes back to, I guess, me wanting to talk about recovery and about the telling of the story.
Well,
although,
you know what, I'm sorry. I don't
God knows I
you,
spent tons
wanna,
of time.
I don't want to I don't really want to interrupt you, but we like to make sure that we stay chronologically, and I want to hear about the recovery, but that is something that we usually visit a little bit later on in the show. If we could just go through chronological events, because I think we're up to, you were in your childhood, and you know, you were 18, but if you could just fill us in maybe on some of the details or memories from the childhood, or some facts, because we like to go through these things chronologically, and we have 90 minutes, so are you okay continue to take us through before we get to the recovery piece?
Sure. So the things that were important to me were the relationships with my brother and sister, the family. I had a sense, like in the beginning, when I think of childhood as that chapter of my life, there was this illusion of family, But that's what I thought. I thought I had a family. I thought I had a large, intact family. Now, I was really, from a young age, interested in music and songwriting, and those are the kind of things that me and my brother and sister did. You know, like those little sing-song games, I would make up a new one, and we would do that together. And my brother and sister are gifted musically, meaning they can sing. I was too, and this is a big part of the story, because that's what was so important to me, was the ability to kind of do those things and engage in those things. And the sexual abuse that occurred set up a geometric form, and they do talk about this in some modes of therapy, like a triangulation. So the beginnings of those false constructs of relationship with other people. See, those are false constructs of relationship. Mm-hmm. Start to get manipulated in the event, which was the sister of my grandmother. She would take out when my mother didn't want us. It was too much for her. She was always saying that. And see, this is, but I don't want to get sidetracked. I want to tell about this event, these series of events, the abuse, sexual abuse that happened, because it really colors the whole rest of my life and the lives of other people who were involved in it, is that so she was always trying to find us places to stay that weren't with her, you know? And it took me a really long time to get it. Such a rejection. I see that now, why it took so long for me to get that. But I could say it, but not really get it, if you know what I mean. So we were left on weekends or something with this person that, and she had a different name too. Aunt Lori was her name. That's what we called her, Aunt Lori. And at some point she was taking, this is New York City. It's New York City. It's like 1957, 1958, 1959, those years in a lower middle class family. My grandmother worked. Anyway, she would, it's really hard. And yet, this is the image that wouldn't leave my mind that shaped everything, is she had these Fredericks of Hollywood magazines, which were very sexual. There were these women with their you know, underwear, women's underwear and lingerie, for some reason, that at some point in the evening, she would take out these magazines. And she really liked my brother, who was a year younger than me. Now, so I saw her more than once actually touch his genitals in a playful way. But the real abuse was, it was like she called him her boyfriend. Okay? And then after this playtime, we would all get to, it was nighttime, we would all get to go across the street and get goodies at the candy store. New York City had these things called candy stores. So that's where the cigars and cigarettes were sold. And anyway, and we would get a treat. However, I began to notice that she would take, remember, my mother was not wanting us all to be there because it was too much for her, whatever us was being too much for her. So he would go with her, and he'd come back with these really cool toys. And I would say, why? Why is he getting toys? You know, why is he getting special toys? And this woman, Aunt Lori, was violent. And she was also at the same time throwing out some of my toys when she was cleaning up. So I remember this clearly, and it comes to light later on because I did get therapy. I did get help, and I did go and live again with my mother and began to talk about some of these things with her. So it stirred up the pot. I want to stay focused because to talk about that traumatic event, I do it so rarely. And yet, as I said, it was always there in my mind. I could see it. And this thing about the gifts and the toys, you know, later on when I pieced it all together, it all made sense, you know. But I think why the biggest piece of the trauma for me, honestly, was that she took him from me. He was my playmate. He was my friend, you know, and I wanted to know why. Why was she taking him? She was calling him lover boy and her boyfriend and all that, but I was too young to understand what that meant. It just meant he was special and he was being chosen by her and he was getting toys too for whatever it was. And I was saying something about it as well, and she didn't like that. So she began to really abuse me physically, verbally, and like there are people who are still alive in my family who witnessed that and saw that, that could tell you that. And yet when the chips came down, as it does, and it did later on in my story, when I needed them to say, yes, you're right, you didn't imagine this, Sarah, you know, that's my real name, Sarah, although actually I was given even a different name, but instead of them doing that, they were on the denial bus, you know, they would say to me, oh, of course we all remember that. But there were events that came up later on in life where they needed to say that out loud. Now, interestingly,
And regular girl, yes, I think that's a great time to break to the panel. Thank you so much for your honesty. And I love the fact that you said you wanted to remember. So I think that's a great time to just kind of take a break, and then we'll go into the second half, your early adolescence time, early adulthood, and cover some of the things that you went through then. And so you got to the point where the abuse started, the physical abuse, the verbal abuse, and thank you for your honesty. May I ask you just briefly, and then we'll go down the panel, and limiting to our questions or any comments that you want to make to Regular Girl, limiting that to about 2 minutes so we can make sure that we hear the rest of her story, and especially the third part of what she's doing now to help others. So may I ask you a question, Regular Girl? The question I have is that how, at this point, childhood, when the abuse started physically and verbally, what were some of the thoughts that you had? Did you blame yourself, or did you, because you knew the history, some history, that you felt that, you know, this pain was being projected onto you? What were your thoughts as a child when you were experiencing the abuse?
My thoughts as a child was the abuser was successful at engaging me and my sister in this triangulation of, he's the chosen one. She would like do too. So she was like tickling our backs, or it was about like just competitive. She was stimulating. So I, as a child, was engaged in that whole game. Why is there something wrong with me? Why is she choosing him? Even though, I mean, because the things she was doing to us physically didn't feel bad, you know, they were like, And so that's, there was this triangulation though, and I haven't even spoken, you know, my sister was present as well, and she was a year younger. So the toys, and, you know, and I certainly wasn't going to tell anybody, because from my perspective at that time, I want to be very clear, you know, it was just more about like, yeah, what's hey, this is a game. I thought maybe everybody was doing that, you know, because the abuse began when I was very young. I was probably maybe 5, you know, just 4 years old. He was 3, you know, maybe even younger. This goes back. The only way you can really track this is about this, you know, where they actually lived and this pull out convertible couch, which is where it occurred. But even when she would come to our house, you know, she made no bones about, like, he would sit, as an example, she would sit in a chair and she would invite him up onto her lap. And this is with the whole family present, but people may be all doing holiday activities, busy with that. But I would notice it, or my sister would notice it, and she would invite him to play with her breasts, beeping them like horns, okay? All and right. I remember thinking... Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, like, what, you know?
There was definitely some shock.
But honestly, if I'm honest about it, at that point, also, even as a child, I was just engaged in the game of it, because my sister was right there. I mean, I just would be there. We were all very close to my left. Why was she choosing him? It was more about that, the tension and the special toys. Oh, gee, was he going to get the big electric, you know, motor battery-operated car this Christmas? You betcha. Well, it wasn't even Christmas and he was getting it. And when I would say, so as a child, I was confused, I would have to say.
Absolutely.
That's where I was.
I hear that.
And I
all
wanted
right.
answers.
Right. Thank you so much for pointing that out, that there was confusion and there was some differential treatment, et cetera. So, Annie, I'm going to bring you on.
Thank you.
Do you have a comment or a question for our guest, Regular Girl? And we would like to keep it to about 2 minutes, if you will, Annie.
Sure. Thank you. Hi, regular girl. I'm Annie.
And, hi, Annie.
And I see that you're a musician and a singer and all kinds of wonderful musical things. And I wondered how music helped you as a child to deal with the abuse.
It was huge. Music is a huge part of this story. So that I would just say that how it helped soothe and comfort me is that I had a beautiful singing voice. I was gifted with that. And so I loved to imitate any recording that I heard that I loved. And I could do that for hours, you know, and be just fine with it. So I would find ways and times to get away put the record player on and do that. Or I would make up songs and act these out with my brother and sister. Now, it was the interference of these by, say, the same person who was the abuser. Like, there were times where she threw out my favorite records. I mean, as a four-year-old, she did this. So my very first song that I remember being absolutely fascinated with was Ring of Fire. I have a memory of myself sitting on the floor of our apartment with that record spinning around and around, and me just getting so thrilled, you know, as I challenged myself to memorize the words, which I did, you know, that I remember thinking, like, what is this? He threw himself into a ring of fire, you know, and asking an adult about it, and them trying to explain to me metaphor. But she threw this record out. When mm-hmm. I love something like that. So see, that's really the abuse, I guess. See, this was a very strange kind of, I think, abuse. That's like at 4 years old already, she would see this and interfere with it, throw my toys out or a couple of records she did that more than once. I'm saying it out loud. I remember.
Right.
Yeah. More than once.
So it sounds
more
like
than one music
it, definitely, it definitely sounds like, regular girl, that music was a comforter to you, but you also experienced some abuse on that point where you were kind of denied in such a way, or there was interference in that mm-hmm. passion, that comforter. Roberta, I'm going to put you on. Remember, we're going to keep it to about 2 minutes. Just to make sure we continue to get all of our special guests, you know, her story out. So if you will, I'm going to bring you on, and if you will limit it to 2 minutes again, and you can ask whatever question, the question you want, or make a comment. It's up to you. Roberta, are you there?
Yes, I'm Roberta. Hi.
Hi, Roberta.
Well, I'm Roberta. Yes, I'm calling from
Hi.
Oklahoma. How are you?
Can you have a question?
Yes, I just wanted to ask I guess I'll have to wait and ask it after a while, because I was just kind of wondering if your childhood, do you still go back into some of the memories of the abuse, or does it bother you, or do you get angry or anything like that now, or?
I'm pausing because I'm maybe wanting you to clarify that a bit more before I answer.
Well,
it's obvious that I still remember, right?
But, yeah, I guess, yeah.
I am an emotional creature, so I do, you know, have emotions that come up, but I would like you to clarify a little more before I answer.
Well, I don't know. I guess because I'm going through my healing process now, and I haven't opened up to all. I mean, guys, I just started my healing process, and sometimes I think of things and I get angry and I rethink them, and I go over and over and over, and you know, and it's like I just give you an, you know, I say I forgive, and then it's like I get angry, you know, and I think of things that, you know, repeatedly over and over, you know, that incident, certain incidents, you know.
So, Roberta, are you wanting to know how she deals with the memories then, how regular girl deals with the memories that come up?
Yeah,
if you could answer that, regular girl. Thank you so much, Roberta, for clarifying that. Go ahead, regular girl.
Okay.
If you could answer, how do you deal with the memories that pop up?
Thanks, Roberta. That's a really great question, actually, too. But I'm going to go back to something that I said earlier, which was that there was this point where I realized that for me, I was going to have to give recovery my all. And I got so angry about that. So you go back, that's what comes up for me in answer to your question, is that it's recovery from those memories that became I gave it my all. And once I gave it my all, my life has taken a different trajectory. So that those same memories, but this is because of the path that I'm on of recovery, that those memories are there to serve a purpose. Purpose is recovery and healing. So I don't run away from them, though. That's I think that's what you're asking.
That's a very good point. Yes.
You know.
Yes,
so.
Regular girl. That's a very good point. I believe that you really pointed out something that is very important for a lot of people that are going through, is to realize that the memories serve a purpose. And for you, you allowed that to be the point you in the direction of healing than to point you in not healing. And so I think that was a very good point in making that, because a lot of people do have those memories that pop up. We have, you know, and they don't just come once, but they come multiple times. And how do you see that? What's your perspective on that? And you clarified, my perspective is they're here for a purpose and they are here for me to heal. Sal. From California, we have Sal that's on the line. And Sal, again, if you could maybe ask a question or a comment that you would like to make to Regular Girl, that would be great. And we're going to limit it to 2 minutes, if you will, Sal. Thank you so much for being here.
Right on. Thank you. Well, I was a victim of child abuse maybe 77 years ago, where a male actually abused me as a child. I lived in my grandmother's house together with my newly married mom and dad. My dad didn't want to leave mom, so he stayed right in the same location with mom. And this person that abused me was probably about 14 or 15 years old. I don't remember the actual incidents, but I told my parents about it. And my mother wanted to do something, and my father wanted to just push it under the table. Very disconcerting. Then I just, kind of went along with it, of course, but that caused me to get into a relationship with a male, which I got involved with as a young child, and because of that abuse. My mother was suffering a lot of nervous conditions and so forth, stress, finally had to be committed to an insane asylum. And I was able to kind of weather the storm. My father remarried, and I got away from my grandma's house, which had a lot of great memories too, but the bad ones surely outweighed the good ones. And I'm struggling with that right now at an age of almost 90 years old. And it's been with me for a long time. And I want to get rid of it. And I'd do anything to be able to get to that point. I've been seeing counselors. I've taken antidepressants and so forth and so on for decades, that they are kind of losing their effectiveness. So I'm at a crossroads right now. So that's why I'm on this call. That's what I'm coming from. That's where I'm coming from. So I'd appreciate any possible. Yes. Thank you.
Well, I think, Sal, this is Penelope, and I just want to say that you are taking a huge step in coming on the show and in participating in the panel and, you know, being a witness to regular girls' testimony. I don't know if you've ever gone publicly and told your story, but, you know, as with regular girls tonight, it takes a lot of courage, obviously, to come and tell your story. But it also, as nerve-wracking as it can be, if you haven't taken that step before, I know you've done a lot of other things like therapy and other modalities. There is something to be said for releasing the truth, telling it to a panel like this, telling it to the world, and releasing, really shedding that shame. There's something about saying it on this, and as Regular Girl opened up the show, something about saying it on this forum and being heard and breaking the silence, because silence is the most prolific enabler of abuse to continue, even within ourselves. Breaking the silence and telling the world is a huge, huge step. And I think you're taking it by coming in. And that's what I first did, to call in as a panelist and participate. And then the next thing I did was come and tell my story to you again as you go to the panel a second time. But I think you're doing it. So I want you to consider coming on the show for special guest night when you're comfortable doing so. But Resident Girl is doing a great job and just exemplifying taking that step and telling your story as she continues to go as we go into the next segment. And it's really
okay, well, tell me this. Should I leave the call right now and then come back tomorrow evening at 5?
No, we want you. We'd like you to stay on and listen if you have the time. We'd like
okay,
you to stay on.
I'll listen for a while, of course, but I got some things going on and so forth. And,
okay.
But I can always call. And what is your name again?
I'm Penelope, and so Tamika and Annie and I were the hosts of the show this evening.
Okay.
My name is
Penelope and Tamika. Okay. All right, Penelope.
And
thank you.
I'd like to respond if I may.
Yeah.
And thank you for calling and sharing with us all what you did, because I think that it, you know, it shows also, you know, you said that you had, you know, you lived life, you did other things, and yet this still was there, you know. And so now you're saying maybe I think that's what your question is. Maybe, or you don't have the question. You've decided. That's why you're here. That there is something important about saying it out loud. If and I remember feeling this way. If for no other reason than there seemed to be so much energy put into keeping that a secret. I remember thinking that to myself. This was, of course, when I was much older. I'm saying this is coming from that thought process. But it still is there. And that is why I'm here doing this, because we still here's a quick little story if I may. So about 9 years ago, I realized that, like, standing up to one's narcissistic mother. Now but let me just continue. That standing up to one's own narcissistic mother was more terrifying to grown men than a lifetime of prison system stuff, you know. Those are the kind of things where you start to get in trouble. That's what I mean, prison system stuff. That the reality was that it was such a huge thing, because you know there's going to be repercussions. And the interesting thing about this thing, whatever it is, this having been a victim of it, is that it doesn't go away no matter how old you are. The fear is still there, this terror of telling on them. Now, here's what I want to finish with, is that there maybe are going to be some repercussions for this, for telling on them. And I'm here to tell you, yes, there are. There really are. And it's dealing with those repercussions afterwards, perhaps, that was the real kick-in of the recovery. That's where I knew I had to find a power greater than myself, you know, and in the form of, you said you've had counseling, therapy. I have a story like that too. But there are repercussions is my point. And it should not be that way, I don't think. And that's why I'm doing this. This is why I'm telling it. And I'm also taking a long time to not do it, not just because it's hard to do, but because there are other people alive. I don't want to, in the process, I don't want anyone else to get hurt either unnecessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Unnecessarily. Those are very real concerns that I have. And this is a new field that we're in. It really is. I didn't know that to the degree that I really know that now. This is a new field that we're in, so that all questions are good questions, because there was enough pain and sorrow as it was. But to create more unnecessarily so, that is not my intention. And I need to require and rely upon a wisdom much higher than my own to do those kinds of things, to do this kind of thing, because of what I just said.
Mm-hmm.
See? And I think we're all. I ended up starting 9 years ago. I ended up starting a radio show called The Orange Jumpsuit Show with Regular Girl, because we've got the wrong people in the orange jumpsuit. I can see that, and it's gone nowhere. I can tell you that it's gone nowhere. I thought because of me dealing with more recovery stuff in me, dealing with it, because. It's just that way. It's just that way.
Right. And I just want to mention before, thank you so much for clarifying that, Regular Girl, the importance of speaking our truth. And but we're not responsible. If people are not ready to speak their truth, that is not ours. We have to speak our truth, because this is something, like you said, we deal with for pretty much the rest of our lives. And we have to figure out how to heal within. And not only that, Regular Girl, you said that we don't want other people to go through this too, so we have to speak our truth. And I just want to make sure, and I know, Penelope, you probably were going to do it, but Sal, you had mentioned about our website, that NASCA.org, and under that, the scan in the middle, down towards the middle of the page, is a contact email that you can email Bill Murray, which his email is on there, and you can discuss further about sharing your story or any other things that you would like to do with NASCA. So I just want to make sure before you hang up that you know there is a contact.
What is your name again? Is it Penelope?
My name is Tamika, Sal. I'm the one
you're Tamika.
Earlier.
Okay. It's Tamika, yeah. Penelope, and another person. Yeah, I do have that website.
NASCA.org. NASCA.org, and towards the end, the middle of the page is Bill Murray's name and his email address. So I just want to make sure, because I know you said that you have to leave, and I just want to make sure that you have that information. But continue on, Penelope. I just wanted to pop in and
I do have this bmurray3@aol.com. Is that the email address?
That is correct, yes.
And the guest shows are, let's see, can you tell me when those shows are?
Monday through Friday. Yeah. Go ahead.
Monday through Friday? At what time?
So we're on Monday through Friday. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday is special guest night. And Tuesday and Thursday are open mics. And we usually have a survivor professional. And what that means is it's usually a topic night. And there's a survivor professional, a survivor who's also in a helping profession, and there's a topic, and it's an open panel discussion. Special guest night, we actually have a pre-selected special guest that wants to come on and tell their story, and that's on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So tonight's guest is Regular Girl. This is her story tonight. But if you'd like to come on and be a special guest, Bill is the person to get in touch with. And he can schedule you for a Monday or a Wednesday or a Friday.
What times would they be, ma'am, dear?
So we're the show's on every night at the same time. It's from 5 to 6
Pacific time. Okay.
Speaking of time,
Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Okay. Thanks very much. I will touch base with Bill Murray.
Great.
And
okay. Thanks for calling. Okay.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Okay. Stay well.
Maybe I have to talk a little bit about boundaries now at this point. Boundaries. Boundaries versus being invisible. See, this, when a child, any form of abuse is a boundary invasion, whether it's physical or verbal, and there was just so much of that going on as we stick with the chronological years. I began to notice, you know, this is the period in my life where my mother thought it was her right to read my diary, you know, and I was clear that it wasn't, or go through my things or throw out my things, you know. And so as children, we don't have what we need to, most of us, intact to set boundaries. And that becomes one of the things, however, that shows up in one's adult life and doesn't go away, right? And that's, for me, that was true. The inability to set boundaries of any kind, at the same time, maintaining emotional rage at people who are breaking them, you see, you know, and this silence,
so,
you know, do not tell on anybody, that persona of the stay invisible, that's part of the persona, becomes problematic. And we need, I think we need to, I needed to learn healthy ways to deal with that. When, say, for an example, let's say if I were performing somewhere and had paid the musicians and then somebody asks to, let's say, this is a bad example. I'm trying to give an example of boundary irreverence in a performing venue. Because there are protocol. There is protocol. And actually for me, that's when I started to begin to learn in a healthy way what some boundaries were, although I had to first go through therapy to learn about what the word boundary means and what does it mean, a feeling invisible.
I think that's a great point. I think that a lot of children that are born into abusive households and face child abuse, we don't even know what boundaries are. We've never learned boundaries, never learned healthy boundaries. And I think those patterns can be ingrained and they obviously in the healing process have to be recognized and unlearned. I think that's a great thing that you bring up. And by the way, I was going to use Kanye West kind of coming up on Taylor Swift's stage maybe while she was performing. Didn't he interrupt her? Wouldn't that be like breaking a boundary?
Yes.
Performing performance-wise?
Upstaging, or they call it upstaging, competition.
Oh.
And that was the kind of atmosphere that was in the house where I grew up, and it didn't need to be there. And I have still strong emotions about that, about how that was handled, because my siblings are still alive, and I wish it had gone a different way for them. I ended up in a health crisis where I had a lot of extra free time on my hands to think about things. And that's the one place that I really wished that, although that may come from being the oldest of the three children, but wished that I had sort of been able to help them more than I did. Then I was a player. See, I feel like if the abusers were successful in engaging me and my brother and sister in this destructive, competitive, weird trip, when I remember and know that we were really great friends. And it could have been a really great thing. And I'm still left at, and this is the God's honest truth, I'm not recovered enough to, like, forgive and forget this. I'm, like, sitting here with this, the knowledge of this story. And, by the way, it's being passed on to their children as well. But it's like, why? Why do that? Why didn't they just get behind it? They would have made a lot of money, too. I had a 4.5 vocal octave range. And my sister and brother were in a shysters either. It's like, why not? Why do the self-destructive thing instead? pit us against each other, make it a bad thing, show off, show off. It's like I was shamed anytime I tried to be this. I was an A student. I loved school. Couldn't wait to go. If my mother were alive, she would tell you that. She told me that as an adult, she remembers it. I wanted to go, couldn't wait to go. I excelled, and I had these sort of, you know, creative musical gifts and was sociable and stuff, and yet something, it was why my story is powerful even to me, though I lived it. It was like some force had to really, like, interfere on purpose, you know, to derail this train that could have been a beautiful thing for me, my brother, and sister. And why? So why? Where did that come from? That evilness, that insanity. Well, when I was later and after I became educated, I come to find out, wow, it really was insanity, for real. But narcissism is very difficult to diagnose. Actually, I've heard they wiped it out of the DSM-5. And yet, to me, and all my knowledge and understanding of it, it is the core issue of most of the mental health going on.
Well, I definitely,
but to stand up to a narcissistic mother is more terrifying to do to grown men. I wasn't even a man. Maybe I could be a woman. So I'm scared. Scared of mommy, dearest. But because this pattern that's in our lives, and so many of our lives, you know, has to be evident to the human beings who are in the system itself. And the only way that I can see that this has not been dealt with is because they themselves know that what I'm saying is true, and so that's why they don't want to talk about it. I'm talking about their own personal histories. Talk about it. And denial, and I know this was in some of the questions that came from the denial, or saying that, you know, oh, you know, it's too much. I'm not going to spend my life thinking about that over and over and over. I'm going to move on. That's not the same thing as a real resolution, to pretend that it didn't happen. Otherwise, it would have worked. That's what our ancestors have done. Pretend it didn't happen. That's not what works.
That's a great point.
Needs to be uncovered. And as it has become uncovered, you know, in the larger world that we live in, you know, like I said, we have this, there's a court case going on right now with Maxwell and Epstein, you know. One of the things sexual abuse does a lot of times is that, you know, there was no boundaries there. So once trouble started to happen in my life, I was promiscuous, is a nice way of saying it. And my sister. But there were many dangerous, and I'm talking dangerous situations that I got myself involved in because of that, because it's just amazing, you know, that I'm still alive, actually. But when I watched those, that's how I knew. I started to get my, that's why I knew that there was something else going on when, even though I had already discovered my esoteric spiritual path, which was a 12-step path, but I was engaged. I had my own personal experience with, they call it white light experiences, and I was exploring. And I just liked those kind of things, philosophy. Not everybody's like this. So I delved into the study of consciousness and higher consciousness from and many religions. And I'm talking about this, so now we're in my early 20s, and, you know, after I've said, oh, I must, maybe I'm an alcoholic, that's it, you know, so let me work this program. I took it very seriously, and I really, really did ask God and the universe. And I was at the verge of homelessness because of my mother and her inability to be a parent, as was my sister. So it's very complicated. There's people who are still fighting about these kinds of issues. But when I, let me see, where am I going with this? But it became my way of life, my spiritual way of life. The to be rigorously honest as I possibly can about myself. That's part of this 12-step path. And to look first to see, and inscrutably so, as though I were dealing with a financial or monetary system without emotions involved, take a look at every situation and see where I possibly could have been at fault. Where could have I been different to make the situation more harmonious? See that, and then freely give to others. You know, which is just my path or my story. That's the 12-step esoteric path, I believe. You know, so I had already been doing that, but see, then there was still this issue of, well, there were these things that no matter what I did to look at it, why was I at fault? Was I at fault? What have I done wrong as, say, an 8-year-old or as a 4-year-old? And I have to tell you that even though, you know, I ended up studying psychology, and there's a part of my story where I became as a counselor and all that, it really was something shifted when there was a qualified professional who asked me that question. He said, Sarah, let me ask you something about this event when you were a child. Think about it. What did you do? What did you do? And his answer was, nothing. You're not at fault. And what I'm trying to say is that there really was a shift in my consciousness, in my path, when that was, that reality was, you know, sort of like, said back to me like, wait, you were not at fault. Where there was a professional who said to me, you were not at fault. You were a child. So there was nothing that you did to deserve that. Because I had been, because of my other esoteric studies, studying things like reincarnation. Ooh, maybe I had sexually abused her in a past lifetime. Well, guess what? It's not the past lifetime. It's this lifetime that we're dealing with. I had to, like I said, give my all to recovery. So at some point, I connected with the foundation of all that, which is, it's this lifetime. Isn't anything that children do to have their boundaries invaded like that? And something needs to change regarding that. And if that's going to be my sacrificing my personality out there so that people can call me a victim lover, you know, a person who's going to stay in victimhood, I will do it. That's the biggest risk, is people say things like that to you. Oh, you're always bringing that up. Or, oh, you're always, you know, you're going to stay stuck in that. Oh, you're going to stay stuck in that. Oh, that's a victimhood. That's what we're dealing with this stuff, is right. to have a knowledge, a real knowledge, though, that no, that's not what's going on here. That's not what's going on here. What's going on here is I'm telling on them, and even though I know there's going to be retribution, I have faith and confidence in a wisdom and a knowledge and a power greater than that. It's going to be okay.
Well, this is Penelope. Would you mind? We're going into the last 20 minutes of the show. So I know you said you had some things to add since you came on the show last time, and I just want to make sure that we can get to those. And also, it sounds like we're talking about also your healing journey. So I just wanted to give you a time check and make sure that we were able to cover everything that you wanted to cover tonight.
Okay, thanks. I would like to cover the part of my life and share about that one of the things that happened in the mid-70s was, and I was living in Hawaii, was that after a few years of this living this way, and I wasn't wasn't drinking anymore, the Navy was recruiting for people to train in the field of being a facilitator for 48-hour prevention education packet. And they were going around the sober, clean community. And for some reason, in Honolulu in the late 70s, there was just a lot of young people from all over the country, from all over the world. We were there. And so I was one of the people, and I said yes. And so we received a group facilitation training from the University of Arizona. And then after that, after I received that, I also saw in that facilitator training, they didn't know anything about alcoholism. That's why they were coming to us. We learned the beginnings of group facilitation. That's what we learned there. But they were honest about it, too. They said, we don't really know anything. But see, this actually was breaking one of the things that's called the traditions of the 12 steps. You're not supposed to get paid for that part of the esoteric information, which is my life story. I wasn't supposed to be using that. And I knew that. But it was way more money than I could have made doing anything else, except this is where I get angry, except, oh, wait a minute, I had a voice like Jewel. Why didn't I just do what she did? You know, the non-victim or her people were saying, why didn't she just do that? Well, here's the part of the story maybe they're not hearing, is that her father took her when she was a little girl and showed her how to make money making music in a bar. Did that for me, ever. In fact, I was done the opposite. I was shamed. I was told I was a show-off, things like that kind of thing. So anyway, what I did was I became a facilitator and a counselor, and this for the Navy in their live-in treatment facility. And this is a hugely important part of my story, because up until that time, this was the 70s, the big boy out there in the playing field, and the only one really, was AA, had the knowledge about what alcoholism was. And what it said was that it didn't have anything to do with your background. Well, it also says that it does in the book. I know the book real well. But in terms of alcoholism as a disease, it was supposed to be a disease that hit everybody. It didn't matter about your background. But once I became a counselor and you had a client load, now remember, you have to do an intake for each person. And I was sincerely looking for the answer to this question. Was that true or wasn't it? And I began to see a really strong correlation between people's early childhood that were problematic or traumatic, and there they were having, you know, what they called them, events, or actually I'm forgetting the word now that they use in the military for these events that they'd get caught for if they were alcohol or drug related. But I'm saying to myself for the first time, for real, and I'm asking God and all the highest knowledge on the planet available, wait a minute, is that true or isn't it? Is there a correlation? But I began to see one, that there was a correlation, that if somebody had a traumatic childhood, their rudder was off. And a lot of these guys that I was seeing were, you know, by now when I was counseling, I was like, so in my late 20s, they were maybe, some of them were younger, but I could see it. It was like, so I started to say to myself, wait a minute, this is, I can't be teaching something that I don't think is true. In addition, I wasn't educated. I could see that they were hiring people into these positions who had no training. They hadn't studied psychology. So what was going on here? It was almost like the manufacturing of a here's that word recovery. And they were hijacking the word recovery back then too at the time. Now I see, you know? But that, no, it was related to something else, to these traumatic events from when they were children. And so to me, the solution would have been to get ready for that, you know, if we are as a country address addiction and alcoholism, whatever we call it, then get ready for it. But you know what I saw? Because then it was time to get credentials. Now you were going to need credentials. So I went to universities and looked. Oh, no, we're not going to hire psychologists in this field, they said. It's just going to be social workers. You're going to need a master's degree in social work. I was stunned. I was horrified. Now, couple of my other, and by then, people, my colleagues were encouraging me to bring music more and more into the workplace with me. And I found it to work extremely well. You know, these were in terms of breaking down defenses and things like that. But there was no such thing really as music therapy back at that time. You know, the concept of that, it was like, why? Where do I go? It's almost like there were no teachers for me, no. And I was a big person with the teachers, and I liked that. I can see that now as an older person. Teachers, mentors are very important. Once they come into my life, I'm set. I'm good. I'm good for the next cycle, so to speak, you know. But I do like to have, you know, some other source of authority for knowledge other than me, you know, other than myself. And back then, there wasn't much of it. I just kind of knew. I didn't kind of know. I really strongly suspected that I was horrified, and I didn't know what to do. So I just left that field is what I did. I quit. And I started to clean houses, which I have a lot to say about that, too, about learning how to clean houses, about why I value that so much. And how just even that in and of itself, you know, was a revelation to me about my early childhood, the lack of it and who was doing what and the control that goes on with it, and all of that kind of thing. But my point was, I guess you've gotten it, is that I think there is a correlation. And so to cover that up and deny it once again is the worst thing that we can do.
So, regular girl, I wanted I'm sorry, I did not mean to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
But I'd like to bring to our panel one more time before the show closes. We're about almost down to 10 minutes left.
Yeah.
Because I know they have
that
a few words to say to you as we close out. So, Annie, I wanted to invite you in to say a few parting words to Regular Girl before the show concludes.
Sure. This is Annie. And Regular Girl, thank you for sharing your story. I really admire your courage in doing it, and I'm really, really proud of you. I don't have any questions, so I'll just say again, thank you.
Thank you, Annie. And Tamika, I just wanted to bring you back on again and have you give you an opportunity to share some parting words to Regular Girl.
I just thank you for sharing parts of your story and really highlighting, Regular Girl, some important concepts that I've mentioned throughout your speaking. So just thank you so much for being here tonight and sharing your story.
Thanks.
Thank you, Tamika. So, Regular Girl, I have a question. So, being that you you enjoyed school, and we're talking about your healing journey and some of the things that, you know, that's always a time of discovery, isn't it? But it sounds like
yes.
School and academics and music, you know, was always a place that you went, sort of your safe place or your solitude. So, did you use your talent of writing music and singing music as part of your healing?
I did that, and then I also, there were a couple of what ended up happening was I left Hawaii and I came back to New York City, but I had a talk with my mother where I told her, because a couple of things had happened musically for me that were very good. One was that I was in the Metropolitan Opera competition in Hawaii. I didn't know that they rotate, and my vocal teacher nominated me to do that. I didn't know that could occur, you know? And I had this horrible flu cold when I did it, but I had ended up learning operatic arias by studying with this woman who was this vocal teacher. So I had that happen, and I was in the Hawaii Opera Chorus there. And then I had written these songs, a bunch of them, like I went through this prolific period where even though I was so frustrated that I still didn't understand the workings of music, I had taught myself guitar. I played guitar horribly, but I wrote these songs, and people were hiring me from various denominations in churches. I didn't belong, say, to them, but they were kind of New Agey. Like, I remember it was a Mother's Day, and so Unity Church hired me to be their guest vocalist. That's what they do, and they pay you. It's like, I was like, oh, that's fabulous. But I was like, gosh, you know, I'd look through the repertoire, and it was just all old stuff. So I thought, I wonder if I could write, like, a song for it instead, you know. So as a result of doing that over a period of a couple of years, I had this bunch of songs, and one day I was a guest soloist at a church like that, singing one of them, and this woman who was crying came out of the audience and said, where's your cassette? You know, cassette tape, where's your music? I want to take this song home with me. And I said, I don't have one. I'm nobody. Really, that's how I felt. I'm like nobody. I'm like this. And she said, you know, well, God's like telling me to give you $2,000 to record, because you need to have something for people. Look around you. There's people crying here. Uh-huh. You know, they want to hear what you're saying. So when I went back to New York after this thing happened again, once again, I was having trouble, you know, paying the rent. But I had learned things. I'd learned things by being a counselor, and that there was this correlation. I said to my mother on the telephone, and there was still long distance charges. I said, look, Mom, let's be honest here for once now. And I got to tell you, I've learned some things about psychology. And I'm not the only one of your three children struggling with what we're talking about. So I want to come back there, and here's some things that have happened to me that are really, really good musically. But, you know, like, I need a place to live first, too. So I did that. That was a conversation with her that was really important, really critical. And then when I got to New York, some other things continued to happen that were sort of moved me in that career path. You know, there were opportunities. And yet, I really couldn't feel it. I really couldn't feel it. And it wasn't until I had my first heart attack, which is in 1996, and it was a serious one. And I had been working as a servant, and just like a slave. I mean, there were no boundaries, you know. So I just, well, it was a workhorse, and I got hugely obese, and I had this heart attack. But I had studied. There were some people, some teachers, and some books I had read that hinted about, like, maybe it was correlated to the other issues that I had going on. And so that's when I began. That's what I decided. I decided, you know what, this is like, because I almost died here for real. And I'm wasting. I had stopped singing really pretty much. And I was cleaning. That's what I did. Empty people's garbage. I cleaned their toilet bowls every day, you know, and I had this incredible 4.5-octave singing voice that for some reason I didn't know about. And there's an interesting part of the life path story. But when I went, so what I ended up doing after this heart attack was, that's when I started school. But I started by going into the continuing education department. And then this is a important part of the story, too. And I decided that I was going to audition for the conservatory. And the woman in the continuing ed department wasn't going to let me do it. They were refusing to let me do it because I was too old, she said. And I was fat. I was unattractive. There was no reason in God's good earth that they would have let me into that program. And yet I killed that audition. I did. I killed it. Just by singing. But what happened afterwards, once I got into school, was that then I had, because the teachers at that university were working musicians. They were still working, even though they were teaching. And there would be these moments, and there I was still in this big 400-pound body. That's when I started real therapy, too, by the way, real therapy. But there was these, I had these things happen where, like, say, the teacher when I was first doing it, they would stop in the middle and they'd say, like, are you? Like, what's your story? Why hasn't anybody heard this voice? They would say that to me. And I'm not telling you all that to be like a hoo-rah-rah. I'm telling you that that's the kind of abuse. And that was the first time that I was validated for it. I went, wow, wait a minute. There's something going on here, you know? I did think, wow, what's the deal? Even back when I was 9 years old, I sound exactly like Lulu singing To Sir With Love. Shouldn't that be worth something in the material world? I remember thinking that, you know, and all the years through that. And yet for some reason, was that ever encouraged in my family? No, it wasn't. But when I got to this performing music degree program, that's when it was validated. That's when it was encouraged. And I just went like, oh my, that's when the revelation of the abuse also like overtook me. Thank God I was in therapy. I went to therapy 5 days, 4 days a week when I was in my undergrad program for performing arts and gained weight. But the therapist told me I would. She said that to me. She said, I'm sorry to tell you, I think if you're honest in here, you're probably going to gain weight first. But the good news is that afterwards, then when it all balances out, it's going to be for real in the rest of your life. But I'm telling you that up front. And that was the truth of it. That was. So I went every day there, thank God, because I was in a performing degree program with people who were in their early 20s, and I was like this 50-year-old fat woman. Nobody wanted to be in my ensemble. And I had just come from a period where I had worked as a nanny taking care of children and dudes. It was almost like I had been a wife and mother without the benefits of that, okay? Meaning that I was completely socially inept. If I had been socially inept to begin with in my 20s, after this period, it was even more so, you know? And it was the love of music, though, that kept me going. Otherwise, I would have given it up. I cried more during that degree program than I ever had in all the years of recovery, years of therapy, because of how important it was. And when I finally learned about music and about how music works and the composition and theory, which is what I had wanted to know. I had written those goofy songs without knowing that, but I knew there was a way. Nobody could ever tell me. I don't know why. I was just always never around anybody who wanted to explain it to me or thought I was really serious. And I was. I really wanted to know music theory. And here I finally was in a place. That's what was going on. And I failed it twice. Cried, so, and I said, first time in my life, I'm trying to say music actually taught me about life skills, the learning of it taught me about life skills in a way that nobody else ever could or would.
That is wonderful.
It was amazing.
Absolutely wonderful. And I'm sorry to cut you off. That is wonderful. I hope you feel that you were able to answer that question. We are down to the last 30 seconds. I know it's 90 minutes, but 90 minutes, the time flies. Time flies during this show. So I just want to say we've all really enjoyed and appreciated having you back on the show, a longtime family member, Lula Girl. You know, on behalf of my host team, which is Tamika Chambers from Oregon and Annie Marges from California, we wish to thank you for coming on. And I've got to sign out the show. So as we always say, as I always say when I close up the show, there are enough adult eyes on this planet to keep every child safe. It is our moral responsibility. If you see something, please say something. Thank you, regular girl, and good night.
Thank you.
No tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was gone. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.